Hey, everybody. This is Dave Johnson, joined by Dan Mancini.
Greetings.
And this is our, semi-annual, semi-biannual, I'm not sure, I know we renegotiated the terms of the old white man cabal, Dan, but I can't remember what the fine print said, how often we need to record one of these.
Yeah, we're, I think we're kind of like the Avengers. We just, we come together when need arises,
that's
when
true.
The world needs us.
Yeah, that's a very unpresumptuous approach of considering our role, I think, in the world. So
yes. And then so, we go off and have our own adventures.
Exactly. And forget that we're actually, that we actually knew each other because, you know.
Right.
Because sometimes.
Yeah, we never call each other for help. Right. It's not the problem.
Even though, yeah, even though the world, you know, the world's safety might be on the line. But that's neither here nor there. This is, of course, Objection, the worldwide leader in contrarian a-holery. And, well, this is kind of a post-mortem, I guess, and a look back at the trilogy of the Hobbit trilogy, which is wrapped, obviously, with the Battle for the Battle of Five Armies. And to, I guess, putting it mildly, Dan, maybe mixed reception, both the trilogy as a whole and the third installment. I don't know. Is that how you would explain it?
Yeah, I think that's it. It seems like it was a downward trend, like this one was less well-received than the previous two.
Yeah.
And that pretty much everybody's opinion that they had before the first movie was released remained intact. No one changed their mind.
So,
on whether or not three movies was a good idea,
right,
or anything else, you know.
Or, yeah, right. So, I guess the position we will stake here is, like, I personally, and we'll kind of get into this, but I did enjoy this trilogy a great deal. In fact, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would, to be honest. And in fact, going into this, even going into The Hobbit, you know, all those many years ago, I kind of went in half-hearted, even though I loved the Lord of the Rings trilogy so much. But I just wasn't, you know, jazzed about it. But Peter Jackson, like, persuaded, he converted me once again. Like, it just took me a little bit of time once again in the world that he created. And I was in, and I enjoyed it greatly, and I enjoyed it, you know, from the stretch run up until this finale, which was just really probably the most action-packed out of every Middle-Earth movie, I thought. But that's kind of getting ahead of things. But that's just kind of where I was with the trilogy, Dan. Like, so-so in the beginning, you know, it was kind of ambivalent about the two movies and three movies, but just was once again kind of swept up in Middle Earth.
Yeah, I think I had the same response where I was not, when I went to see the first one, I wasn't that excited about going to see it. It was like, yeah, you know,
right,
I'll go check it out.
Like, be dutiful. We're being dutiful about this.
Right. I was very hesitant about the three movie thing. I thought, well, two makes sense. Because I'd read the book a few times as a kid, and I think once as an adult, and it was like two.
As you were mandated, of course.
Right. Yes. So I thought, well, you know, two movies make sense. I don't know that three does. But then, as soon as I saw the first one, it was like, oh yeah, I'm totally clear on where he's going with this and what he's adding in, which really mostly comes from Tolkien. I think we've talked about this before, how everybody's complaining that, oh, Peter Jackson's made up all this stuff. And really, he hasn't. He's taken stuff.
Aside from, I guess, one big exception, right, would be Tauriel.
Yeah, and the white orc, too, was not, he was already dead by the time The Hobbit happened in the books.
That's true, but he was a real character.
Yes.
So that whole storyline, for sure. But I would say, out of Holdcloth, I think Tauriel is probably the biggest invention.
But it made sense to me, and it made sense that Peter Jackson would choose to tell the story that way, in a way that connects it back to Lord of the Rings. Why wouldn't he? Why would he make a kid's movie, essentially, which is what people who want one movie or two movies are asking for? They want it like a book, which is more like a kid's book. But if he had made that, everybody who's complaining about the fact that he made three movies would be bitching about the fact that tonally, The Hobbit is nothing like The Lord of the Rings, and it's just for little kids.
Right. I mean, in fact, it's really hard to measure it against Lord of the Rings because, I mean, I guess Tolkien kind of retconned a little bit of it in subsequent editions, right, of The Hobbit.
Yeah.
But this was never really, I mean, this, it's hard to draw that straight a line from The Hobbit to Lord of the Rings trilogy. So it just seems like it's where Peter Jackson's obviously looking to, you know, prequelize and just develop a six-episode story, I would say. I mean, I mean, that's that was his goal, and to me, that you should kind of measure him on the success of that goal,
right?
Perhaps rather than I want, you know, my kid's book, and I read The Hobbit as well, and I enjoyed it, but you know, it's certainly not like I don't think it's kind of in the realm of The Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's kind of like it's almost a succession of playful, enchanting fantasy non sequiturs.
Right.
That's what I always thought of The Hobbit. You know.
Right. It's really episodic, which means if you made it, right. If you just straight made it into a movie, it would feel very disjointed. It'd feel more like a TV show on a big screen. And all the stuff with Gandalf in comes from Tolkien. Tolkien wrote that in other places, explaining what Gandalf was doing and how it ties back into Sauron and everything. So it's not like Jackson made that stuff up. Most of it comes from Tolkien directly. And going back to Azog, the white orc.
Yeah.
I just like the fact that it's like a whole bunch of people complain that orcs are basically non-European. And so from Lord of the Rings, and so they basically created a Swedish orc for The Hobbit.
Yes,
you know, blue-eyed. If he had hair, he'd be blonde, clearly.
The Dolph Lundgren orcs.
Right, right, exactly. Very pale skin. You know, it's like, look, this is not a non-European guy. This is not an African or something. This is a Norwegian, basically.
Yes, there you go. So I guess, you know, taken as a whole, looking at all three movies, I really was just kind of, I just really loved this last installment. I thought, I mean, just from the opening, I mean, when you have Smaug, and again, we're going to have spoilers in this, but when you get Smaug get waxed before the title card shows up, I mean, that kind of tells you what you're in for. And I thought, you know, all the build-up, I thought all the beats, like, Jackson hit all the right beats. I mean, and I came away from that movie, aside from, I guess, maybe Gareth Edwards, right, who directs The Raid, right? Isn't that scary?
Right, yeah.
I don't think there's a better action director working than Peter Jackson, just as far as, like, blocking action off and putting it together so that it makes sense and you can see what's happening and hitting all the right beats, like all the emotional beats.
Right.
I thought, like,
and this,
all came together.
I really thought, in this case, like in Lord of the Rings, there are fantastic battles in Return of the Kings, but it's essentially he builds up to this battle, and then the battle is there, and you have these little character moments that help to carry the suspense and stuff. But when battle is happening in Return of the King, there's not a lot of story happening. And in this movie, for the first time, I felt like Jackson built on that and was able to actually tell story while the battle was going on. It wasn't like everything just led to the battle and then, okay, story stops and there's a bunch of fighting. It was character development and plot were happening while the fighting was happening, which is most of the movie. You know, it felt like a good, I don't know, hour and a half. I could be wrong. That's what it felt
like.
An hour and a half of the movie was the battle.
I was trying to think of the downtime here, and it's really, the downtime is the poor dregs of Lake Town pulling themselves together, and then just kind of the political jockeying with Thorin, right?
Right.
Before all hell breaks loose.
And it's like the battle in this movie is the thing that draws out who the characters really are. In the end, it pays off all the characters. They're forced in that battle to kind of become who they are or reveal who they are or, you know, whatever it is from Thranduil, you know, Legolas's father and everything else.
Go character by character and kind of just give your thoughts on how that was revealed, maybe, you know, just the major ones.
Right. I mean, you have the Thorin thing where he's crazy and then kind of finally finds his honor again, which is a big deal. And there's been a lot of criticism of that and dragon sickness and all this kind of stuff. Hey, these are the people who apparently wanted it to be faithful to the book, and that's what it is in the book.
Absolutely.
He gets the gold, he goes nuts,
right.
And he finally kind of gets his act together and does what he needs to do. I thought Thranduil was really interesting, what he goes through in terms of not wanting to help the dwarves, kind of doing the right thing. I thought they nailed that character throughout, because that's always, those elves have always been the weirdest part of that book to me.
Yeah.
They're just weird, and it's all kind of personified in him. And Lee Pace did a great job, I thought, playing that character, because he's just weird.
And if you think about it, like, the rest of the Lord of the Rings, I mean, this is really, like, the most elf, I think, like, this is, like, the most elf exposure we've gotten. I mean, you've had, obviously, you had your Elronds, right, and you had your Legolases, right. You know, you had the, and, you know, Galadriel for a little bit, but they were just kind of, like, individual characters. This was, like, the most kind of full-on elf exposure we got, as far as just kind of their approach to things, maybe, you know, their just their mindset, and I thought that was one of the really interesting elements of this particular trilogy. And the dwarf, the exposure to dwarf civilization and culture. I mean, The Hobbit really fills in all of those, you know, because again, with the Lord of the Rings, you're kind of gotten a few points of reference, but now you get to see the whole dwarf culture, all of elf culture, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. You know, the way a lot of the events kind of resonate with what goes on in Lord of the Rings, so that when Thorin kind of snaps out of it and starts to lead the dwarves, how it changes them in battle is a kind of setup for Aragorn's importance in Lord of the Rings. And
how about Legolas? Obviously, all Legolas, that stuff. You know, here was another kind of, you know, sort of a creative liberty Jackson took, really, you know, getting Legolas in there. Did you find it to be, like, everyone likes Legolas, and he's cool, and he did awesome, badass stuff, but as far as his character, what did you feel the trilogy did for his character in the context of all six films?
In that battle, for the first time, it felt like he was actually terrible. Like, he had an opponent who kind of took him to the edge.
Oh, yes,
and,
right.
And could have beaten him, potentially, which... I don't recall that being the case in Lord of the Rings. He was just like the one Jedi among a bunch of regular people in Lord of the Rings. That was cool. I like that that at the end he kind of feels compelled to go off on his own.
Right.
And it sets up his meeting Aragorn and everything, which is cool. To me, it worked. I don't know that the elf-dwarf romance worked entirely. But I also knew where Jackson was going with it, that there had to be some kind of emotional resonance with Killy dying.
Right.
And, you know, if you've read the book, you know that's going to happen. And in the book, it's not dramatic. It's just literary.
Right.
You find out, oh, yeah, he was one of the three guys who got killed.
my equivalent to that is, like, you know, Boromir's death, right?
I mean, right.
Like, in Fellowship, he just kind of gets smoked, right? And again, I think it was universally regarded that Boromir's death is one of the most epic, right, that we've seen. That was, you know, there was a lot of license taken there. So, and the other thing with the romance, it didn't feel, I can never, like, distracted. Like, I'm distracted from anything. It's not like he, in fact, I mean, if you weren't the biggest Evangeline Lilly fan, I mean, she wasn't really super present in this movie, you know? She does show up at the end. She offers enough of that emotional connection, for sure, to get, which I like. I mean, it gets Legolas super pissed, you know, because I thought we were all looking forward to that final, you know, battle between those two. So that helped as well. But, yeah, I think it added just enough a little emotional resonance. And I never felt like, looking back, it never felt like it was distracting or you know, again, I was reminded kind of Liv Tyler in the Fellowship, right? Kind of people.
Right.
A little upset about that. It's like, in the end of the day, did she really, like, distract anything? She added a little bit of emotional spark, but, you know, she was, like, non-existent in the second one and barely there in the third, and so it doesn't really make that huge difference.
I mean, a romance between an elf and a dwarf is kind of bold because it's there's a silliness aspect to it, unintentional silliness aspect of it, but... Nobody should be surprised, and it shouldn't be controversial, that they inserted a woman into the story.
Right.
Because it, you know, to not do that today would have garnered all kinds of complaints.
What about Bard?
I like the expansion of that one, too. You can't just have a guy who doesn't do anything but stand on the shore of a lake and shoot Smaug. And that's it. That's your only connection to the guy.
Right.
Like, he's not really he's an archetype, I guess, in the book, but he's not a character. There's no backstory. There's nothing about him. He's just a human who shoots the dragon.
And you're totally right, because in the actual text, like, Tolkien introduces him parenthetically. They're right. Like, you know, they talk about him and say, oh, by the way, his name is Bard. Like, it's like, you know, it's an afterthought of who this guy was.
Right, and giving him a family, you know, making him kind of the Han Solo of the movies is, I didn't have a problem with that at all.
Right.
I'm glad they did it. It's sort of the same thing as having Faramir doubt or have him be tempted by the ring in Two Towers, which he was not in the book.
Right.
But it makes him human, and it makes him, it dramatically, you know, you can talk about the difference between drama and literature, but dramatically it makes him more noble and more human to have him tempted and then not take the ring.
Right.
Not try to take the ring the way that Boromir did, than to just leave him the way he is in the book, where he just doesn't even try. It's like, well, there has to be drama in the movie. And there has to be, you know, Bard has to be a character in the movie. He can't just be some, you know, hire a character actor and throw a cloak on him and give him a bow. You know, and some of that stuff is making it, bringing it more into the realm of Lord of the Rings. I'm glad that they didn't make it so that Smaug was just, his belly was covered in gold, and that was the thing that made him invincible, except for this one spot where it was missing, you know, that it was just his scales, and he was huge. And that's the other thing that it, and this is more the second movie than this one, but I kind of find it annoying that people are so focused on this shouldn't have been three movies, which I don't agree with, that there was no conversation about how Smaug is the greatest movie dragon that has ever been put on screen,
right.
Period. Like, nothing even comes close. That's what we should be talking about, is the centerpiece of this trilogy is we got the movie dragon to end all movie dragons. He was huge. He was awesome. He was badass. Yeah. Smart, a talking dragon, no less.
Right.
Fire, and, you know, he was badass.
And I had no idea how Jackson was going to, you know, build his death scene. I thought that was actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
That was pretty affecting, actually. And see, that's the other thing about the Five Armies, and I guess the Hobbit in general. I mean, I continually saw stuff that I'd never seen before.
Right.
You know, and these days, that's become more and more important. Just so, like, again, just, even if there are small beats, like the giant troll with a battering ram on his head,
yeah,
right, who ran into the side of Dale and then died,
and that other one that had no legs, and it had,
that's
like,
right,
you know,
that's right, absolutely,
and it had like chains in its eyes or something,
right?
Like, it was a bizarre troll.
It was a bizarre troll. So I just think, like, those, just seeing these things I'd never seen before, and the other, and some more credit for the plot, like I. Coming out of Smaug, I wasn't sure how they were going to reconcile the Gandalf-Sauron reveal and all that stuff,
right.
You know? And because I thought, well, you know, how are they going to explain why Gandalf was kind of just hanging around for 60 years or so?
Right.
You know, and
why everybody seems surprised that he's back,
so,
you know?
That's right. So, you know, I think with Galadriel kind of banishing him, right?
Right.
And I think there was some dialogue about, well, obviously Saruman goes saying, I'm going to go kind of take care of this. So, but I think in the Lord of the Rings mythology, we know that Gandalf has kind of been aware of this and been grinding and hard at work,
right?
And and Aragorn has been preparing for this. In fact, you know, that's actually been a criticism of mine I had for the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I actually preferred the Aragorn just kind of laying low,
mm-hmm,
right? And just prepping for his day in the sun instead of being the reluctant king. Like, I understand the need, you know, why they dramatically did that, but I'd always liked that idea of,
yeah,
this guy knows he's, you know, the premium badass in the world, but he's not ready to kind of pull the curtain back just yet. So, so I guess if you read the books, you kind of knew that no one was really dawdling for all this time. You know, they knew that something bad was percolating.
Yeah, and I like the fact that, A, they have Galadriel kind of beat him back and send Sauron to Mordor. Presumably.
Yes.
And then
right.
They also very explicitly set up, you know, I think it's Saruman who says, look, we don't have to worry. He cannot come back physically because he doesn't have the ring.
Right.
So they're setting that up well. And then it makes sense that Gandalf begins to piece together by the time, you know, Frodo's on the scene that, ooh, this may be the Ring of Power, and that's a problem.
Right. Yes, definitely. So I thought actually that the connective tissue holding that together is pretty good. So here's another criticism I've been hearing a lot about is like the CGI overload. Everything is CGI, right? And I would be the first to kind of, you know, I'd be the first to decry all that. Just, you know, CGI in general, I suppose, when not needed. But I just don't know how you make a movie like this without CGI. You know, I think there are practical orcs when needed. There are definitely more practical orcs and makeup and whatnot and props in the Lord of the Rings, in the original Lord of the Rings. But even that was really just CGI all over the place. So I just, you know, I'm more than willing to, like, look past that. In fact, I thought it was still pretty enveloping. I mean, Azog was totally CGI, and I bought him as a physical presence and a threat, you know? I think... And the CGI was so well done. And everything, by the way, you know, done in broad daylight, which I thought was great. You know, I love that. Love that so much. So I didn't really, you know, I didn't really have a problem, even though I tend to be sensitive towards CGI in some things. But I just, it's part and parcel for a huge fantasy like this. And it was so well done that I was kind of wrapped up. My sense of disbelief was suitably suspended.
Yeah, I thought it was a lot better executed from top to bottom this time around than the last movie. The last movie felt like all their dollars went towards certain effects, like Azog, and then there were things where it was like, ooh, that's pretty shaky. There are a few things in there. I will say that, I don't have a problem with the three-movie thing. I like the story elements they brought in for the most part. The Tariel Killy thing is not the greatest thing in the world, but like you say, it doesn't really distract. My biggest complaint would be this trilogy doesn't feel as kind of handcrafted as Lord of the Rings. It doesn't look it. It's not a huge thing to me because I do think it still works. And those armies and stuff. And in the first movie, I thought they did a really good job of, there were just goblins and stuff that you can't put a guy in a suit and get it. They did a good job of, well, if we're going to use CGI, then we're going to make these creatures that aren't physically, we can't do it through prosthetics anyway. We'd have to have a puppet and it would look ridiculous. So I didn't have a problem with that. I could go for a little bit less and a little bit more practical, but I think I'm with you that it's not that big a deal.
Right, and that's my default position generally. And I guess, so for me, I think the ship kind of sailed with... So it was interesting, when I look at Fellowship of the Ring, like you talk about goblins and the Balrog and whatnot, you know, but when it came to like the big battle at the end, you know, the Battle of Amon Hen or whatever, those guys were largely practical.
Yeah.
You know, and that really had a street fight sort of feel, fight to it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as the movies progressed, they kind of got more and more, Helm's Deep obviously was pretty big. There was some definitely practical stuff in there. But, you know, those, by then you had armies that were largely CGI. And Return of the King was, like, pretty much entirely CGI instead of the up-close and personal scenes. So he did kind of scale it up. So
yeah.
I thought he had set up that kind of realistic feel in the beginning, at least the practical feel, then kind of scaled it up. So, you know, so by then you're accepting a Shelob CGI and all these huge... And all these huge armies, but with the Hobbit, he's kind of just
giant elephants.
Giant elephants. You know, so I would say normally I do practical as much as possible. I would say in Desolation of Smog, it did seem a little awkward. Legolas's kind of street fight with Azog's little brother. It did seem a little like, boy, just kind of get Lou Ferrigno and some white paint here and make this happen. But it was a little. Here and there, but I knew I was looking at CGI. I mean, when Legolas is running up a crumbling, bridge. That's
Legolas.
CGI.
I mean,
that's Legolas, know. Right? So, but and that kind of goes to my point. I mean, this is kind of a fantasy adventure. This isn't a feature film procedural where they CGI a car crash or something. You know, like,
right?
That's
I think that's a really good point. That I bet if I were to go back and watch it. Visually, The Hobbit looks a lot more like Return of the King than Return of the King looks like Fellowship of the Ring. I bet. Because there was a ramping up of computer-generated effects in the Lord of the Rings trilogy as they were given more money and more time to do stuff. And, you know, it's not... even when I talk about the handcrafted stuff, it's not like the difference that you have in between the original Star Wars trilogy and the prequel trilogy, where there's 17 years and it's just a totally different approach to special effects, and it just doesn't really look or feel the same as the original. I do think the world looks the same. I think the, you know, I don't know about the frame rate stuff and how crisp that, I haven't seen it in, I don't think, at the 48 frames per second, super crisp digital, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it definitely on Blu-ray, they are more crisp than Lord of the Rings. That's not a huge surprise, because Lord of the Rings is 15 years old. No, the first one, which is crazy. Or 14. But, yeah, I don't, you know, again, people are going to complain about anything, I guess.
So, I guess, just general kind of, like, I mean, do you look at these separate, I mean, I never looked at Lord of the Rings as separate movies, you know, I just kind of looked at it as one kind of cohesive narrative. So,
right.
You know, there are elements that I don't love as much as other elements, and I think the same with this. I think there are parts, like, you know, weirdly enough, something I've never seen before, and it should be cool, I never really loved the end on Desolation of Smaug with all the furnace and the, you know, and the big fight with Smaug.
Yeah.
And it's just like, again, it was, I guess maybe because I knew it was a wasted effort, right? I knew that no matter what they did, it wasn't going to...
Right.
Yeah, I kind of knew it was coming, so that was like, okay, this is kind of cool. It just seems like a lot of work for that.
That's the part of that movie. Yeah, that's the part of that movie where it felt like they created a set piece and then built the movie around it.
Right.
You know, that hole in the gold statue and stuff,
right,
which is not a good effect. I mean, that would be one of the things.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it would look like if you had that much gold and it got melted, but still, it's like, oh, that looks fake. So, yeah, I would agree that all that running around, and whereas the, you know, Bilbo talking to Smaug was really dramatic.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was menacing and smart and scary and all that kind of stuff, which the other thing we haven't mentioned yet is, because I thought this from the time I saw the first movie, and I thought this movie paid it off and delivered it, is Martin Freeman's Bilbo is the best Hobbit in all six movies. He's the most likable. He's the most competent. He's the one, you know, the way that he changes is very admirable. He seems smarter than Frodo, more collected than Frodo. I mean, I came away like, I like that guy in a way that I didn't feel about Frodo.
I would say, I would kind of go as far as to say, I mean, I guess Ian McKellen kind of stands apart, but man, I thought, as far as like quality of acting, I mean, I thought Martin Freeman's, you know, may have been the best in all six, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like Ian McKellen kind of holds it all together for sure and totally just disappears into Gandalf. But just as far as like, just like the little things that Martin Freeman brings to that character, you know, like any interaction he has, I just thought it was just kind of like really noteworthy in a big way.
And
probably
I think
even more so in comparison to Elijah Wood's rather kind of wispy take on Frodo, you know?
Yeah. And thinking about it, it's like, I think what makes him so great is that he's basically Frodo and Sam rolled into one person.
Yeah, that's true.
So he doesn't need that. He's still like the moral heart of the...
Right.
Of the story, the way that Sam is in Lord of the Rings. And he's able to, you know, it's in large part him who helps Thorin snap out of it.
Yes.
Right. And the little talk that they have. And he kind of is pretty bold in saying, look, you're completely screwing this up.
You know, I think the other illustration is like when Bilbo earns respect from his peers by things he says, like in... you know, in the first film when he says, you know, your home was taken from you and I'll do what I can to take it back. Like, you know, like I really, or when Thorin on it, as he's dying, you know, I thought that was actually a pretty potent scene, just Thorin and Bilbo together as Thorin's dying, and Martin Freeman played that devastation pretty well.
Yeah.
I felt like, I believe that. I believe that the Hobbits actually liked this guy, that the friendship was real, they appreciated him. Versus, like, you know, sometimes I felt like all the awe given to Frodo was more because it was written in. You know, like, right. It had to be there, you know, versus, you know, he was brave and stuff, but, you know, it was mainly because he was so little and unassuming and people were surprised by him. I always thought that Martin Freeman gave Bilbo a little more, I don't know, gravitas, so to speak. So you believe that people, like, okay, yeah, good for him, good on this guy. So.
And then it boiled down to, for Thorin and Bilbo, to this really personal interaction I thought was great. But given the way that Thorin is treated throughout the story, as this almost legendary figure among dwarves and king and all this stuff, that in the end, he's just looking for Bilbo's approval, basically, and forgiveness for what he's done. He's it becomes this very human, like, hey, I want to acknowledge I really messed that up. And he's looking for Bilbo to forgive him, basically. Which is pretty strong, storytelling-wise, I thought. But, you know, critics have skipped over that, because there's no plot in Battle of the Five Armies, apparently.
Nice. All right, well, any closing thoughts on The Hobbit? And maybe in all six, because I think it's obviously it's safe to say we're not going to get any more Lord of the Rings movies. I mean, I think...
unless he decides to do whatever, the Silmarillion.
I guess, but that's kind of been, isn't that been kind of locked away? I thought there was the Tolkien estate had kind of put something under lock and key.
Yeah, let's hope. I mean, it's like enough, you know, let it be. much as I would like to revisit that world, because it's great.
We don't need a Brett Ratner's Presents the Silmarillion, I suppose.
Right. So. And it's not connected to this other, you know, to the story that we've just seen and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I look forward to the extended edition release on Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
And just marathoning through six incredibly long films.
That's right. Boy, there's a, so, I mean, that will be an epic. That will be an epic journey. But unlike the Star Wars films, I'd be confident in saying I could start from 1 to 6. You know,
yes.
I were introducing my son to this, it'd be we're going 1 to 6, because I thought, like, when all is said and done, I think I most appreciate about this trilogy is how it does seem to integrate so well. Like it does feel like one part of a larger whole of six movies, and just, everything just integrates so well. So.
Yeah, and with the kind of framing device. And having the older Bilbo and stuff at the beginning and the end, which I thought was one of the weakest parts of the first movie. It was like, come on, let's get going. Do we really need to?
Right.
But now that it's all done, I do think it helps to connect the two better. And it'll be interesting to, you know, finish this film at home and then plop in Fellowship of the Ring and see how they connect up.
All right. Well, that's it. I think that's the end of this objection for The Hobbit. We are firmly in favor of it. I was really surprised to see kind of the Rotten Tomatoes scores be so sort of middling, you know, kind of in the 60% area. So, I don't know. It just felt like...
It is baffling.
It just felt like some, you know, there was some preconceived notions here. But, again, to each their own, I just found it to be immensely satisfying. You know, was it... Did you take a tiny book and expand it 3 giant movies? Yes, but you know, I don't think there was a lot of wasted frames in there, and I thought it was, I mean, high entertainment all the way through.
Yeah,
it was
never agree.
Not entertaining, and there's so much new. So that's that. So thank you, Mr. Jackson and company, and all of those great CGI workers.
Yes,
who worked overtime. I'm sure they earned their paycheck. So with that, we thank the Old White Man Cabal for
of course
their generous their generous donation. I believe one of the Cabal actually modeled Azog.
I'm sure with those blue eyes and very pale skin.
We appreciate you, unknown shadowy White Man Cabal.
Yes,
who did that?
We're expecting that our Christmas scotch will be here at any time.
Yeah, extra malty. Right. So okay, but that said, I mean, actually, there's only just one last holiday sentiment to leave people.
Thanks, 10 points easy.